From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. It's 4th of July weekend, Independence Day, the birth of a nation 244 years old, so young and clumsy and naive, and at the same time so hopelessly worn out and almost ready to give up already, and so far removed from the simple good versus evil struggles that gave birth to America, even as that birth took the lives and the lands and the liberty of so many human beings, so many children of God in the name of God who so loved the world that he made America exceptional. Happy Independence Day. Eyes wide open, hearts torn open, we stand in a moment when we may yet let freedom ring louder than ever before, or we may never July 4th again. Both are possible. Both are inevitable. Heaven help us. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you haven't pitched in yet, please do so. Information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief Radio.
In 2016, the Trump faith was Name It and Claim It, Make America Great Again, the prospect of the restoration of a mythic, read white, past. Now, though, the kingdom has come. Trump is no longer storming the gates. He holds the power. The faith for 2020, I learned at his rallies, is a secret one. Its password a wink that's really a warning, its enemy invisible and everywhere. The deep state, the pedos and the FBI, Democrat-ruled sanctuary cities and the illegals they send forth to pillage the heartland. MAGA has become CAG, Keep America Great, which requires not a new prosperity but the eradication of America's enemies within.
Those are the words of best-selling author Jeff Charlotte from his invaluable Vanity Fair piece on the people populating Donald J. Trump's re-election rallies. Uniquely skilled at exposing the theocratic threads that animate our politics and our government, Jeff will be with us later in the hour to discuss his experiences while researching the article headlined, He's the Chosen One to Run America. Inside the Cult of Trump, His Rallies Are Church, and He is the Gospel.
President Trump tweeted, New York City is cutting police by $1 billion, and yet the mayor is going to paint a big, expensive yellow Black Lives Matter sign on Fifth Avenue, denigrating this luxury avenue.
For many veterans of the American Civil Rights Movement, the attention and support Black Lives Matter and associated actions have garnered are both gratifying and frustrating. The frustration that so much is still undone and not understood is only compounded by the silence of many, mostly white churches in this country. On this week's show, I'll get the thoughts of longtime civil rights leader, the Reverend Dr. Amos Brown. But first,
the facts in this case were that this law would restrict the abortion providers in Louisiana to one in New Orleans for the nearly 10,000 women every year who seek abortion services.
Two more important decisions at the intersection of religion, government, and politics were handed down by the Supreme Court this week. One ruling, Espinoza v. Montana Department of Revenue, sided with troubling practices of funding private, often religious, education with public dollars. But the second, June Medical v. Russo has the potential to finally limit state-level schemes to deny women the constitutional rights recognized by the Roe v. Wade decision in 1973. The absolutist argument against the right to choose is relatively new in Protestant circles. Scholars document that it dates back to only 1984. And American Catholic bishops formed the National Right to Life Committee in 1967. More than denominational dogmas, though, it is the political clout of these traditions that is most worrisome. They have successfully shifted the conversation to the point where a fetus can now be called a pre-born person, and active lobbying for full rights from the moment of conception create deadly dilemmas for medical professionals in many places across this land. While efforts at the federal level to repeal Roe only escalate, numerous state-level shenanigans relentlessly chip away at access to abortion services, particularly for women living in poverty. With the Supreme Court, led by Chief Justice Roberts, taking a step in the right direction, I wanted to look at the issue through a religious lens, and I am happy to welcome Glenn Northern, Domestic Program Director at Catholics for Choice, to State of Belief Radio. Glenn, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. I am delighted to be here.
By the way, I am speaking to you from Louisiana, where I live. Just, if you will, briefly summarize what June Medical was all about.
Basically, they upheld their own decision in Whole Women's Health, which is that the restrictions that the sort of admitting privileges that the state was requiring were unnecessary and an undue burden for the women of Louisiana. So yeah. They basically upheld their own decision in Whole Women's Health. It really was a pretty common sense decision in that way. It's an incredibly important case, and Catholics who are very supportive of abortion. In fact, I want to say for the record, straight up and out loud, that Catholics are pro-choice. More than 6 in 10 Catholics believe that abortion can be a moral choice. And it really comes for Catholics from this point of the idea of conscience. Conscience is a very sacred concept to Catholics. It is our belief that every individual is obligated to follow his or her conscience, and we respect the right of others to do so. And so this case really underscores for us that important piece.
Glenn, will the June Medical ruling have widespread impact, or are the anti-abortion forces too adept at coming up with a variety of different strategies?
They are very adept at coming up with different strategies. Even today, we still see a number of states that are still trying to restrict abortion access all over the country. This is an important step forward, but really we will need a legislative solution to this. The Women's Health Protection Act is legislation that will truly safeguard access, because what we've seen over the last decade or so is the Catholic bishops urging conservative, ultra-conservative religious politicians to further restrict abortion time and time again by any means that they possibly can, whether it's with trap laws, the targeted regulation of abortion providers, or whether it's with misinformed consent laws or waiting periods. At every turn, conservative politicians are trying to restrict the moral autonomy of individuals trying to access basic essential health care. The reason I mentioned the Women's Health Protection Act is because this is legislation that would truly once and for all safeguard access to abortion across the states, because it's really unfair. And from a Catholic standpoint, we view this from a social justice angle, and it is morally wrong that some people should be able to access the healthcare they need where others can't. And that's really what we have in the United States, where some states are very, very restrictive and others are less so, it really winds up with folks having a patchwork of ability to access the healthcare that they need. And this sort of runs counter to the way that Catholics believe that, you know, the sense of equality, the sense of each person should have the access they need.
Yeah. How was Catholics for Choice involved in this particular Supreme Court case?
So we were part of an interfaith brief with a number of organizations, Christian organizations, Muslim organizations, Jewish organizations, and others, who really pointed out to the court that many religions have a very different view about abortion than the ones that the Catholic bishops and the ones that our opponents, the legislators in Louisiana, had sort of put forth in the law. The point that was being made in the case for us were several. One, the idea of religious liberty. It is wrong for any one religion to impose its religious values across the entire nation. And secondly, that the majority of people of faith across many different denominations actually do support the right for each person to make their own choices around healthcare and around abortion. Mm-hmm. And for the court to sort of take this position that's basically imposing the view of a minority is wrong.
Were you surprised by the decision and by Chief Justice Roberts' role in it?
I was surprised by the decision, but in another way, I absolutely was not. It really did make sense given the 2016 case of Whole Woman's Health that it should have been an open and shut case in a lot of ways. And I think Roberts, as a judge, I think we have seen from him a respect, at least at some level, for the rule of law in general. And so in many ways, it is relieving to see that he sided that way in this case. But again, it leaves us still with much work to do in protecting this access, because we still have a patchwork. I mean, it is legal across all of the United States, but people's ability to access abortion is trickier.
I think a lot of people are surprised by the name of your organization. Would you talk about the group's relationship with the institutional church?
Sure. So Catholics for Choice lifts up the voices of the majority of Catholics, the pro-choice Catholics, both here in the United States and across the world. In the United States, there are 70 million Catholics. Only 300 or so are bishops. Mm-hmm. Yet the bishops claim to speak for all Catholics. And we know that this is absolutely not true. It's not true in a variety of ways. Individual Catholics and the bishops disagree on the role of religion in the public sphere. They disagree on the role of contraception. They disagree on abortion. And we give voice to those Catholics. We represent those Catholics, the majority of Catholics. And it's our job to basically speak up and say, when the bishops say, we speak for all Catholics, we are the ones that say, no, you speak for yourselves. You do not speak for all of the Catholics.
Yeah. Why is it so important to your members to advocate for the values they hold, and they hold them specifically as Catholics?
One of the things that we are seeing at the moment is a very awful distortion of a number of values that are important to Catholics. So I mentioned earlier the idea of conscience. Conscience is a very sacred concept to Catholics. It is both our duty and a gift for us to follow our conscience. And it's not to be trifled with, and it's not to be interfered with by someone else. And yet what we are seeing is the bishops and others sort of encroaching and distorting this notion of conscience. Conscience is not something that can belong to an institution. It is something that belongs to an individual. And so both in this case, in the upcoming case on birth control, we see the bishops and others sort of really taking this very sacred notion of conscience and distorting it in such a way that it leaves out each individual's moral agency, each individual's ability to determine for themselves by the sort of quiet inner stillness in themselves what is right and wrong. Thomas Aquinas actually said, "He that goes against his conscience always sins." That's a very powerful statement. And so it is really not the state's role to intercede in that way and undermine an individual's conscience. The second part is really that notion of religious liberty. We see the bishops really trying to distort that, and Catholics reject that. Mm-hmm. Catholics reject religion being used as a form of discrimination. Catholics reject the idea that abortion can't be a moral good. They actually do believe that abortion can be a moral choice. And so I think it's so important to us because we are the majority, and we need to make sure that the bishops are not claiming to speak for us.
Right. Tell our listeners, please, how they can keep up with what you're doing, and if they want to, how they can support your work.
Absolutely. Certainly they can come to our website. It is catholicsforchoice.org. Also following via social media. As many organizations do, we have ways for those individuals to speak truth to power, both to their legislators. We are always looking for activists to speak in public forums as Catholics using their faith voice. We work with legislators across the country, Catholic legislators, to help them speak in their legislatures from a pro-choice faith perspective and help them give voice to the fact that they are both pro-choice because of their faith, not in spite of it.
Glenn Northern is Domestic Program Director at Catholics for Choice, working to be an expression of Catholicism as it is lived by ordinary people. CFC led a coalition of groups in submitting amicus briefs in this past week's important June Medical v. Russo decision. Glenn, thank you so much for taking time to be with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been absolutely my pleasure.
We're just getting started with this week's show. Up next, a first-person dispatch from the Trump 2020 reelection worship services with author Jeff Charlotte. And later, longtime civil rights leader, the Reverend Dr. Amos Brown, on which lives really matter and to whom. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I'm Welton Gaddy. It was 2016 that one of our favorite guests, best-selling author Jeff Charlotte, was with us reporting on his personal experience of attending some Donald Trump campaign rallies. A keen observer and chronicler of human behavior and beliefs, Jeff once again waded into the sea of red hats and provocative oversized T-shirts earlier this year, just before the COVID-19 crisis overpowered America, and lived to tell about it. His reporting of the experience makes for spellbinding reading in the pages of Vanity Fair magazine under the headline, "He's the Chosen One to Run America. Inside the Cult of Trump, His Rallies Are Church, and He is the Gospel." Oh, Jeff, just in time for Independence Day, too. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. Well, and always good to be with you.
How many Trump re-election rallies were you able to attend before the COVID crisis and our botched response defeated our nation?
This time I only went to three, and I felt like I wanted a range. I went to Bossier City, Louisiana, which is outside of Shreveport, Hershey, Pennsylvania, the so-called sweetest place on earth, and Sunrise, Florida, and Broward County. And as I reported in 2016, when I also went traveling around to rallies, I wanted to see a sort of a spectrum of rallies. And then, of course, there's this whole world most of us are not a part of where people watch these rallies over and over. They watch their favorite rallies streaming, and you can find them all on YouTube. And it's a little bit like Deadheads, Grateful Dead fans who have their favorite shows that they come to again and again, and they come to their favorite bits, their favorite songs, or in this case, their favorite moments of Trumpist violent rhetoric, and you play it again. And so that's what I was sort of interested in. What was the experience on the floor of the arena, and then what was the shape of the rhetoric and how it had changed since 2016?
Jeff, you paint a picture of a population that sees dark conspiracies around every corner and that fervently believes apocalyptic disaster is being kept at bay only by this sanctified president. What kind of campaign ad is ever going to break through that?
None. None. And, you know, I think the idea that we're going to somehow convince someone like, say, a woman I met in Sunrise, Florida, Diane, her name was, was a devout QAnon believer in the QAnon web of conspiracy theories. She believes that the Democratic Party elite are actually cannibals and that they're eating children. And if you said, that's crazy, this is just an unhinged person, that's what I thought the first time I encountered that idea. Maybe the second and the third. By the fourth and the fifth, I realized it's not the majority view, but it's widely present. And even those who don't subscribe to that extremist point of view say, well, I don't think that they're actually cannibals. They're trafficking children, sure. So, no, this is not something, this is not a campaign ad issue. This is not politics. It's why I say this is working much more along the veins that you and I understand as a religious appeal.
Is there any way to estimate how many in the president's base are the kind of devoted, mesmerized followers that you have met at the rallies?
I think that's the kind of quantifiable research that I'm not doing, where you really want a social scientist. What I will say is this. I mean, I was interested in what's going on at the rallies. And the rallies, of course, are a self-selected group. They are big. I should say this. A lot of liberals and lefties and secular folk think, oh, it's all just smoke and mirrors, or it's paid actors and so on. If these are paid actors, they're the best actors I've ever seen, and they all deserve an Oscar. The rallies I went to, as in 2016, were all filled to overflowing. 22,000 people in Broward County, which is a Democratic stronghold, and more outside. And so it's self-selected. I mean, and it is true that there are people who travel from rally to rally, again, like Grateful Dead fans. A friend of mine called it the Hateful Dead, going from one to one. But what struck me was that I was hard-pressed as I wandered this arena to find someone who had the sort of the view, you know, maybe they're just sort of like, well, I like Trump because I like tax cuts. And there didn't seem to be ordinary Republicans anymore. And in fact, booing the Republican Party is part of the ritual. Trump trots out the Clintons and you boo, and he trots out the Bush name and you boo. There is no party. It's a kind of, they feel they've transcended party. There's only Trump.
Yeah. Jeff, I find myself thinking that there are more than enough of them to take to the streets armed to the teeth were their leader to ever say, defend me, or my reelection was stolen, or one of any number of outlandish claims. None of them more outlandish than the kinds of beliefs you heard rally attendees willingly espouse to you. This is an enormous powder keg, as I see it, Jeff. Am I being too dramatic about that?
No, I don't think you are. I mean, look, we're at a moment when, as kind of moderate and centrist a figure as Joe Biden himself said, yeah, of course I'm concerned of what happens if I win the election, but Trump refuses to leave. You know, to think about that as mainstream, you know, political talking point, that's really astounding. And then to see it reflected on, again, talking to the rank and file believers, yeah, absolutely. There is no fair election that Trump could lose in their mind. And of course, Trump has doubled down on that. I followed the Vanity Fair piece up with a shorter piece, a sort of a close read of the Tulsa rally, in which he returned to the rally trail, which a lot of people read as a defeat. And there was a defeat. The fact that only 6,000 people showed up, that was good news. And we should be encouraged by that. The fact that 7 million watched it on TV, we should be concerned about. Mm-hmm. And what's really happening was there in that rally, I felt it was a turning point. He turned what some understood as incoherent, was a failure to recognize the working of Trump rhetoric, which he turned up to 11 in that rally. And there was a point at which he said, you know, the other side's very violent. Our people are not, unless they need to be. And then if they need to be, that will be a terrible day. And then he goes on, he says, on November 3rd, you're going to reelect me unless we do something stupid. And then you know what to do. You know what to do. He says it twice. So I don't think it's any, I hope that's not going to happen. I think there's a strong possibility we will just send him packing and get him out. But the prospect of real violence, well, it's not even out there. It's already happening. And all the so-called lone wolf attacks where, you know, you have individuals who have been mobilized and you see it at the rallies in which people are openly fantasizing about violence. This is how I think of the rallies, as they're essentially a ritual by which he stamps his name on the American dream and transforms it into a revenge fantasy. But that's what the American dream is. It's about crushing and hurting your enemies, and your enemies are everywhere.
Yeah, so well said. Jeff, the people you describe are archetypes and anachronisms, and it strikes me that they are profoundly American. The lore of the colonists and fur traders and gold chasers that nobody reads anymore is full of the kind of mysticism, superstition, and unfounded conviction that you describe finding at these rallies.
No, I think that's so well put. When you first said, you said the archetypes and anachronisms, and I was about to say, but Welton, they're Americans. And then you got there ahead of me and said it more eloquently than I could have. I think what was interesting to me was in 2016, when I went around to the rallies, the theology, as I understood what I was seeing, was really a kind of prosperity gospel, you know, which I think of, and, you know, as sort of a country cousin, right, to mainstream evangelicalism. And for listeners maybe not familiar with that, that's the sort of the late night televangelist saying, you know, send me $100 and God will bless you tenfold. And you know this is true because look at my private jet. So obviously I'm anointed, right? And that was sort of what God, that's sort of a lot of what Trump was offering in 2016. Now it's taken this darker turn toward what I think of as a kind of an American Gnostic gospel. And I'm not the first to sort of notice, as you say, that kind of Gnosticism, this idea, this belief in secret meanings and layers of meanings and so on, that is an old part of the American story. That has been with us for a long time. I don't think I've ever seen a president harness it before and bring it from the fringe to the center. And I think that's really important for us to understand. There was a part where I was talking with this woman I mentioned, Diane, and I was wondering, you know, am I even going to be able to use this interview? Because it's so far out there. She was claiming that the horrible shooting in Las Vegas at the country music festival, where I think over 50 were killed, was part of a Saudi-led conspiracy to kill Trump. And I said, this is so far out there. And then I go home and I look it up on Google, and it turns out a U.S. congressman is proposing this idea on the Tucker Carlson show. I wrote my story for Vanity Fair, which is a big slick glossy with a big circulation. Tucker Carlson's got 4 times the audience. You and me here having this conversation, we're the fringe, unfortunately. Yeah. Those conspiracy theories that were once at the margins the gold chasers and the trappers and so on, they have moved into the center.
A terrifying part of your reporting, really terrifying, is the utter demonization of the quote-unquote enemy. Democrats, Muslims, liberal lawmakers, progressive judges, and an endless list of other targets dehumanized and identified as a threat. No evidence is necessary when the leader insists, believe me, not your lying eyes. And allies can be created just as arbitrarily, Vladimir Putin at the top of that list. Where does that leave those of us who cling to reality?
In trouble, and especially you and me, Welton, who have a journalistic bent, because that, I think, what emerged for me from this round of rallies is there's all those enemies you talk about, although they can change, and the allies can change, and people who complain about inconsistency are missing the point. The enemy is who Trump says is the enemy. The friend is who he says is a friend. Jeff Sessions is a friend one day, he's the enemy the next. That's fine. Yeah, don't believe me, right? And in fact, he says at all of his rallies, there's more than I can tell you. Let me tell you these dark, twisted things that are happening. For instance, in Hershey, Pennsylvania, that Democrats in Philadelphia are actually going through their jails looking for animals, that dehumanization, to release into the countryside. Now, implicitly, the animals, of course, are people of color. The countryside is white Americans. And there, they're going to, as he described, they're going to rape, they're going to decapitate, they're going to disembowel, they're going to carve with knives, they're going to eat hearts. I'm not being hyperbolic. That's his language, but played out much longer. The number one enemy, though, are not those, not those actual human beings. It's the prop that's in the middle of the floor at every rally that agrees to serve as the heel in wrestling terms. It's the press cage. Most of the press goes into a metal cage, I like to just attend as a regular person. And there's a point, he says, look at those scum, those terrible people, those liars. And that's the biggest scream of the crowd. And I think what's happening is you need an enemy within. Every authoritarian needs an enemy within. And for that enemy within to really function and to really maintain the level of paranoia, they have to be able to pass. So Jews in Nazi Germany, communists in Cold War America, or for some elements of the Christian right at certain points, the gay man as a singular archetype, could be anybody. Your children's school teacher might be a gay man or a communist or a Jew. How can you say? Journalists now perform that function in a way that actually undocumented people and immigrants don't. Because in the Trump imagination, they're the wrong color and they're easily identified. But a journalist, why? For all I know, you might be one yourself. Your own child could become one. And how would you know? They're an invisible enemy within, and it's sort of drawing on the form and structure of the protocols of the elders of Zion. And that also has the added effect of anything you hear from anyone but me is suspect. I'm the only reliable source of information.
Yeah. Jeff, one reason your reporting on these rallies is so valuable is the profound empathy you have for the disaffected and the disconnected. Your recent book, This Brilliant Darkness, was powerful proof of that. We talked about it on this show. So without asking you to play psychiatrist, do you have a sense that there is something, anything that might help fill the space in these zealots that is currently filled by Trump and Trumpism?
I do, actually. And I think we're seeing it right now, which is a real left, a genuine left. That is actually challenging power. I think of the very first man I met in Bossier City, Louisiana, an Iraq war vet, had been a UPS driver saw 9/11, heard it on the radio, and got out of his truck and signed up. And then went over there and volunteered to do the work where you're, you know, you're disabling bombs in the road. Very, very dangerous work. Was horribly injured. Would said he would come home and he would on break and he would watch the news and it was all fake. Well, now he's at a Trump rally, so you know what he's thinking. He says, "Well, what do you mean? What would it real was?" He says, "Well, I knew what we were doing was we were just it was blood for oil." He says, "We were clearing the way for Halliburton trucks, for oil trucks, and they said we were fighting for freedom and we were just killing Iraqis for no reason." That sounds to me like a person with a left critique, a critique of power. But where was he to go? Diane G, the woman at the center of the story with these very elaborate QAnon conspiracy theories, her moment of disillusionment came with her work with poor children through her religious, not through her church, but through her ministries, with poor children in Haiti. She saw what the Clintons, the work the Clintons did in Haiti. And she's not wrong in saying it was terrible. Even Bill Clinton says, we tried to apply a kind of free market American economic model and caused incredible damage. I think he called it, we ended up doing a deal with the devil. She lacked the structural terms to critique that. So she turned to the terms of her church. She couldn't talk about neoliberalism. She didn't know about laissez-faire capitalism. So she called it spiritual war. There was an absence of the critique of saying, hey, look, you're right. Something is wrong here. This is not the way it's supposed to be. But frankly, she looked at the Tweedledee and Tweedledum of the national parties. And there are real differences, but not enough. Yeah. And Trumpism was able to sweep in and grab that up. Right now, I am a little bit encouraged, though, by the fact that we are seeing this real challenge to power in the streets and in the, what I hope will be a sustained demand for justice, for Black Lives Matter, for looking at not just tinkering at the edges, but asking real deep, profound questions about what kind of world we want to live in.
Yeah. So this leads right into that. What do you want every American to understand about the people that you met at what you bluntly described as Trump worship services?
I want people to understand that they are, with as much empathy and sympathy for them and hope that some of them can see another way. Right now, they are real. They are dangerous. They are not talking about politics. They are talking about a kind of total war, something that I have said on this show in years past, talking with you. I said, I don't think fascism is possible in America. I was wrong. It's here. And the biggest thing that the liberals are making this mistake again, we just saw in the New York Times, Frank Bruni had a column yesterday, Trump is toast. The 2020 election is already decided. Same headline we had in 2016.
Yeah.
Don't count him out. Don't count him out. This is a real movement. This is a struggle every bit of the way. And then the day after the election, no matter who wins, because whether Trump is here or not, the 200 judges he's put into power will remain. The generals he's elevated, all the agencies and departments he's remade in his image, many of those people will linger on. So that struggle is real. We are now going to be in a sustained struggle with the open and explicit prospect of an American fascism.
Jeff Charlotte is a best-selling author and writer whose essential book, The Family, was recently turned into a Netflix miniseries. Please make sure to read Jeff's Vanity Fair article, He's the Chosen One to Run America. Inside the cult of Trump, his rallies are church, and he is the gospel. We'll link to it from stateofbelief.com. Jeff, it is almost unbearable to look directly at what we have become, but we must look at it, and we must stare into it and think about what we're seeing. And for thanking you, I am thanking you for helping us do just that today on State of Belief Radio. Always great to be with you, man.
Thank you, Wilton. Likewise. Thank you.
The Reverend Dr. Amos Brown is president of the San Francisco branch of the NAACP and an effective civil rights organizer and leader for many decades. As the national outrage over Black lives still not mattering escalated, I was fortunate to be in private dialogue with Amos. He is a longtime friend. Our dialogues are always stimulating. In a recent conversation we had, his insights and perspectives were so valuable that I felt compelled to share that access with our listeners, and so I'm grateful to have Dr. Brown back on our show today. Amos, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for the opportunity of sharing with you and your audience again. There's an old saying that if you don't get your lessons, you will repeat your grade. And I think it's most unfortunate that in the human family, we have not learned our lessons. And we keep repeating this grade of destroying each other because of that Trinitarian evil of racism, materialism, and militarism.
Amos, we mark this 4th of July with enormous challenges facing our nation, but the fact that those challenges are too enormous to ignore, the failings in leadership, healthcare, racial equality, also create a moment when true change looks possible. Do you think the American people are up to the challenge we face?
I'm not sure. I'm cautiously optimistic. Why? Because there have been these passages before in history when we thought that we were on our way to a change during the period of Reconstruction. But what happened? We got the backlash of the Ku Klux Klan, which was a terrorist group to suppress the Black vote and to destroy any semblances of Black self-determination and empowerment. And we went through a long period of separate but equal. And though we had the Civil Rights Movement, we had hope then, and with the marches, demonstrations. But then we got this backlash again of George Wallace, later Richard Nixon and his law and order. And you have today Donald Trump consulting that playbook of law and order, always blaming the victims, never thinking deeply to gain an understanding of why there is violence in Chicago. There's a book that I would recommend that your audience would read, entitled 1919 by Miss Ewing, a great poetess, but she has some very profound preamble statements to every one of her poems explaining why there was this race riot in Chicago in 1919, right around the same time that there was a Spanish flu. And here we are in 2020 with the racial violence going on and Donald Trump trying to play racist politics, not trying, he's done it. And anytime he opens his mouth, he talks about law and order, talks about police being victims and they need to get tough. All of this is going on now. And I hope that there will be a miracle somewhere and change the trajectory of this country, because we're going down the same path that we went down 100 years ago and even times before that. Going back to the days of Aristotle in the 4th century B.C., before Jesus of Nazareth was born, he came up with the nonsense that Blacks, the Ethiopian, were inferior because their skin is dark, and that the only way we could become somebody, we would have to go up to Europe and become lighter. And he also said, and this is documented in his work, The Politics, that the Ethiopian would never be capable of self-governance. He would always have to, or she would always have to have a white man, a white woman over him. Mm. So you see, this is in our DNA.
Yeah.
It is, as Jim Walters said, our original sin, the sin of race, of dividing up the human family and never looking to see consistently that there's one human race and we made of one blood, as the scripture says, and everybody needs blood. You need a blood transfusion. Your blood type is A and mine is A. And if you don't accept my blood because my skin is dark, you'll be a dead duck on arrival at the hospital. But that hasn't gotten into our conscience at all. It's still a problem around the world, even over in Europe, in London. They are marching, saying Black Lives Matter. So that's my deep concern, that we have not learned our lesson, and we were repeating the grade again.
Amos, I know that you have spent your entire life fighting for racial and economic justice. We're seeing a lot of things going on around us now that give people, some people, hope. Is something happening now that you see that is different from the incremental change that we were able to bring about in past decades? Do you see enough difference this time to give you hope that you didn't have before?
Well, the only thing that's different, we have more people involved, different personalities, but the evil is still prevalent. We still have not gotten a hold of ourselves and acknowledged that racism is wrong. We have not had truth and reconciliation in America as it did in South Africa. And you cannot have reconciliation unless the oppressors come to grips with their guilt. And there's been too much of an attempt to explain away, to rationalize what's going on. And many are in a state of denial, so that I just will not feel happy or content until we get rid of these glaring economic disparities in the Black community, mm-hmm. until we get rid of this blatant gentrification that destroys Black cultural enclaves. Until we get rid of low achievement in school systems. For example, in Chicago, last year, over 50 schools were closed down. Now, mind you, we're closing down inner city schools at a time when we are spending billions of dollars on the military. And you have this president who wanted to have a big parade exhibiting the weaponry of this country. He's not about going to the table and negotiating and being a part of a world community. He and the religious right have been espousing nationalism. You know, my nation over against your nation, and this dichotomous thing of them against us. That is ruinous to the human family, and we need to master that little pronoun, we. But this man has been about my. I, and he is guilty of the sin of Adam, like many of us are, of playing the blame game instead of being held accountable for one's actions. You know the old story where Adam blamed Eve, and Eve blamed the snake. The poor snake didn't have nobody to blame. We must stop the blame game and assume responsibility for what happens in these communities where police are going around beating up on Black people as they always have done when they had the slave catchers back during the days that we resisted. That's when the police department really had its genesis in this nation.
Amos, when I think about you and our conversations, I know your mentors and your friends were Martin Luther King Jr., Medgar Evers, Benjamin Mays. I love hearing you talk about these people. What do you think they would say, seeing the state of our nation and activism today?
They would all say, how long, oh Lord, how long? How long will it take America to realize that democratic republics don't last unless there is justice, equality of opportunity, civility, and respect for the worth and the dignity of all human beings? Regardless of how different they might be, they should be respected. From these giants whom you name, they all model dignity, elegance, humility, and they have the nerve to speak the truth to power centers without being bombastic, without being mean-spirited. They were human, yes, but they stood above what we are experiencing today. The leadership in this nation is in trouble, and they were quintessential examples of quality leadership.
Yeah.
And that's why even here in California, where I reside, the Proposition 8 was bannered around. Though I came from Mississippi, where there was conservatism around me, a little interpretation of the Bible, but thank God for the churches that I was reared in. They were all social justice churches. Fair Street, College Hill, Pearl Street AME Church. Just a handful, but they made great efforts to follow Jesus and not imperialistic, oppressive religiosity. And I thank God for that tradition that I met before I went to Morehouse. And my civil rights activism was advanced sitting in with Dr. King and hanging around Samuel Woodrow Williams, who's pastor of the oldest Black Baptist in church in Atlanta and president of the Atlanta branch of NAACP. So we need to have this generation of activists to read the lives of these great giants who dealt with this evil of race in a sophisticated, loving, yet forthright manner. And that's what it's going to take. Because Dr. King was right. If we don't learn how to live together as brothers and sisters, we're all going to perish as fools.
Yeah. Amos, my background is not the same as you. I didn't have the teaching that you had. And so I think back to the civil rights era of the 1960s and painfully recall how silent most majority white churches in this country were on the question of racism. Plenty of them even spoke out in support of segregation. So perhaps it shouldn't be surprising that we see some of the same things happening today. I know you have strong feelings about this, and I want you to comment on it, because I think I see some white evangelical leaders who seem to be actively undermining the fight for racial equality in this country now.
Again, history is repeating itself. Well, back when the times that the Civil War was coming, what happened? It was the church house that defended slavery. Even Southern Baptist Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky, was founded on the sale. Even you had the Methodist preacher who had that revitalization of the Ku Klux Klan in 1915, Simmons, at Stone Mountain outside of Atlanta. So we would maybe been further down the road toward a better day if the faith community had not buttressed and supported racism. Even Jerry Falwell supported racism and segregation. Liberty College was started as one of those Christian schools, those Christian academies back in the late 50s and 60s, to get around the Supreme Court decision. And even today, you have Moeller, president of Southern Seminary, candidate for the presidency of Southern Baptist Convention, supporting Donald Trump all the way. Now, I hate to invoke these names, but there are times when in the prophetic tradition, you have Franklin Graham, who supports this man. It was in 1952 the very year that Brother Franklin was born, that his father, in my hometown of Jackson, Mississippi, to go to the end of pulling down ropes at the first segregated crusade in the state of Mississippi. Hugh White, the governor, had insisted that if Billy Graham came there, he would have to speak to a segregated audience. But I, as an 11-year-old child, saw this man leave the podium at that stadium of Bailey Junior High and pull down those ropes, go back up to the podium at the cross. There should be no segregation. But his son, Franklin, has taken the ropes to make, so to speak, a social and spiritual noose in these times. And I have talked with him personally about his honoring his father's legacy of pulling down the ropes and his working to complete the unfinished agenda of ridding this nation of racism and division. So my prayer, my hope is that we go to the book and read it. It says that judgment begins in the house of the Lord. And the religious folk, the so-called Bible Belt, would come together as reason, as I said, talk to each other, listen to each other, hear each other. Then maybe we can create a better image of America around the world. And we indeed shall be worthy of being emulated as one nation under God with liberty and justice for all.
The Reverend Dr. Amos C. Brown is an African-American pastor and civil rights activist. He's the president of the San Francisco branch of the NAACP. He has been the pastor of the Third Baptist Church of San Francisco since 1976. Amos, thank you for doing your part in bringing us toward a more perfect union. I cherish you as a friend. I thank you for every time you're being willing to come on State of Belief Radio and give all of us insights that we would not have without you. Thank you so much.
And I congratulate you for maintaining the forum in which we can have these kinds of informed, spiritual, and practical conversations around what we must do.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. It's Independence Day weekend in America. Weary and worried. 244 years old today and still a newborn. Please let me wish you patriotism. The clarity of vision that the sacred freedom to take a knee during the national anthem means nothing when the national anthem's words are no longer heard by those who sing it. That burning a flag will never disrespect it as much as forgetting the sacrifices made by so many to preserve the fundamental freedoms its stars and stripes represent. That tearing down misguided post-Reconstruction statues of traitorous, seditious slave owners is nothing compared to the dismantling piece by piece of the values represented by the Statue of Liberty. And give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. Again, yearning to breathe free. In 2020, BLM George Floyd, America, hear that anew. And recall the next line of the Emma Lazarus poem, The New Colossus Cast Upon the Statue of Liberty, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. My fellow Americans, we have forgotten And with that all-encompassing we, I mean all of us together. And so it doesn't matter if 54% or the voters in the blue states or my particular Facebook friends have not forgotten. As a nation, a melting pot, an e pluribus unum, we have forgotten that the Statue of Liberty stood tall for all to see, and the Golden Door words of Emma Lazarus, the Jewish poet, were available for all to read. And still, America turned away scores of desperate Jewish refugees fleeing Nazi Europe a scant few decades ago. We have such profound failings in our bloodline, and yet have risen to atone and to include and to lift up time and again. It's not inevitable that we will manage to do it once more. It's perhaps not even likely, but it is indeed truly still possible. Free Speech brings you State of Belief every week, but your donations help keep us on the air. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and be part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.